Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. On Saturday the 4th of August 1945, at 8:55 a.m, Frederick Keeling, a driver for Taxi Lux, a local cab company, pulled up outside of 16 Greenhall Road in Harleston. The street was silent, as the residents were roused by the chirp of a dawn chorus and the clatter of a milk cart. Having loaded the first of his fare's luggage into the boot for what should have been an unremarkable day, it was then that Frederick saw Cyril. Standing outside of his wife's lodging at 12 Greenhill Road, a short, stocky man in an army battle dress slowly approached him. His face a ghastly white, his mouth agog with shock, and his pale hands dripping with a deep red ooze. Although slow, he didn't stumble like a man in pain, but a man in shock. As in his hands, he held a curved knife, which continuously dripped with the fresh warm blood of his victim. Stopping by Frank's car, the driver stated that he didn't feel afraid, as Cyril wasn't seen as a threat, but as someone who needed help. And as the soldier shook his bloody hands, spattering the pavement below, in a quiet voice he uttered, "Get the police. I've done my missus." And as Frank drove off to find a phone box to call the police, Cyril walked out of Greenhill Road. Only this wasn't his escape, as he didn't even attempt to flee. Keen to give himself up, amidst a gaggle of gobsmacked pedestrians, this bloodied and dazed soldier trudged half a mile north to Harleston Police Station, his sluggish demeanour like he'd just emerged from a battlefield. And with Frank's frantic call coming in, by the time Inspector Coote and Sergeant Furster had driven 100 yards, the unmistakable sight of Cyril Padmore was walking towards them. Pulling up, he stated, "I've done my wife in." He gave them the address. He confessed, "I did it with this," having handed them a small curved knife from his right trouser pocket. And being cautioned, Cyril's only reply was, "To think it was an Italian she'd been going with." In a police report dated the 11th of August 1945, Inspector Coote wrote sympathetically of Cyril's case, stating,
"The motive of the crime is most apparent, and it cannot be disputed that the moral character of the deceased woman, Kathleen Padmore, was of the lowest."
Outside of Cyril and Kathleen, there was one other person who, it can be said, was to blame. A And although anonymous, that someone was known only as Joe. It was during those dark and lonely days of the war that Kathleen's lack of morals came into question. As witnessed by landlords, lodgers, locals, and even her own children, no one was decrying that her desire to be loved was lacking. But it was the uncaring way in which she went about it that caused whispers to spread from Farmall all the way to Burma. Described as coarse and mouthy, those who disliked Kathleen were said to be unsurprised when a welfare officer called, when she got evicted from two farms, and when her children were placed in their uncle's care, all within the space of a year. Many were shocked at how unashamedly she'd had sex in the woods, and even with one, if not all three of the lorry drivers, as her daughter slept beside her. But what riled them most was her fornicating with the Italian fascists, who Britain was fighting against. One of those who spoke up was her sister May, who she had always had a fractious relationship with. When questioned, May selectively told the police, "I have seen Kathleen on numerous occasions in a field having intercourse with a lorry driver named Gordon. She also carried on with the other driver called Bill. I have spoken to her about her conduct, and she has told me to mind my own business." And although her statements of Kathleen's morals were cherry-picked, it was like calling a pot kettle black. As according to those same witnesses, her morals were no better. George Podbury, the landlord of Woodend Cottages, stated, "I began to think that immoral things were taking place in the cottage. And I told the women I would not let these men in. They took no notice. I received abuse and insults when I spoke to them." Possibly out of spite, May had blabbed about her sister's filthy ways. But according to Joseph Wiley, licensee of the Seacourt Bridge Hotel in Botley, often it was three women, identified as May, Kathleen, and one other said to be one of May's daughters, whose behaviour was so bad, I asked them to stop. And whereas Horace, the brother of both women, was the uncle put in charge of the children, instead of it being their Auntie May, he would state, "I've seen both women going out at nights to woods near the cottages with Italian prisoners of war. I have also seen them returning at 7 a.m. and it was obvious to me that they'd spend the night in the woods with the Italians." In her statements, May acted like she was an angel. Only it's hard to call someone immoral when by your own actions, you're no more moral than you are immoral. She told the police, "I don't know the names of any of the men. She was very secretive in nature, and she told me very little about her men friends." Which was a blatant lie. But as Edward, a lodger in the cottage, would state, "May was all right until Mrs. Padmore arrived. Then she seemed to lose control and told me once, 'This sister will ruin me.'" Between January and May 1945, at the nunnery in Aynsham, the farm's landlord, Gordon Blake, said Kathleen was one of two women, the other being May, who were consorting with the prisoners. When questioned, Antonio Frenzo and Mario Saviello of the No. 45 camp said that they knew both women only to pass the time of day, with Mario only acquainted with May,
and Antonio having never had sexual relations with her. Although, even just admitting to that during wartime was a criminal offence. But was there more to this than just sisterly spite and bitter jealousy? Maybe not. In late April 1945, May discovered that Kathleen was pregnant. Shortly afterwards, Sybil received a letter in Burma from an unidentified person known only as Joe, who told him everything and could even provide a list of possible fathers. But not only was Joe the nickname that Mario gave May, not only did she later draw up a list of possible fathers for the police, but the letter written by Joe was said to be in a similar handwriting to May's. That letter led to Kathleen being investigated by a welfare officer, having her children removed into care, to her eviction from the lodgings and a paying job, and it ended the relationship with Antonio. Whether that was May, we shall never be certain. But a second letter was also sent by Joe. Dated the 28th of May 1945, it was sent to the commandant of the No. 45 prisoner of war camp in North Hinckley. It read, "Dear Sir, I feel it is my duty to write to you as it concerns a British soldier, a wife, and their 5 children. One of your men, Antonio Frunzo, also a married man, is going with a Mrs. Padmore, who is using the name Miss Stanton. Will you please stop this man seeing this woman, as her husband is away in Burma? Yours respectfully, a British citizen." And although sent anonymously, Mario would confirm it was sent by Joe, as it impacted on him too. That day, Kathleen moved into 12 Greenhill Road to anxiously await Sybil's arrival. Only May's bitterness towards her immoral sister was far from finished. Arriving at St. Pancras Station, granted 28 days leave owing to his wife's conduct, he sorted a place to stay and he headed off to see his children at the home of their uncle Horace at Lower End Farm in Thrupp. I asked Mr. and Mrs. Jenning and my wife's relations what had been going on while I was away. So helpful was May to this mild-mannered man whose heart had been ripped in two, that according to Sybil, off her, I got a list of names. She said the list was of the men my wife had been going with. And handing it over, she added quite maliciously, "When you see your wife, ask her to pick the one out of the list." But even he would admit, this might have been done for spite, because my wife and her sister fight like hell. During his stay, May said, he questioned me about his wife's behaviour, and I told him the whole truth about everything, except of course about her own immorality, and during the time, he couldn't eat or sleep. Torn by his tired head and his broken heart, Sybil, who had often had concerns about his wife's fidelity, having cheated on her ex-husband with him, had begun to question which of the 4 children that he assumed to be his were actually his.
born in the period when he was stationed overseas. Civil looked at his youngest daughter, three-year-old Kathleen. And when Horace had asked,
"Do you think it's his?"
It was then that Civil replied,
"They're just like the bastard."
And having wiped his hand across his brow, he huffed and gruffly uttered,
"Jesus Christ."
Civil had always been suspicious of who his daughter's father was, as ever since the previous Christmas, when he had read a letter written by Kathleen to Frank Tobin, then landlord at 36 Randolph Avenue. He saw it was signed off with the words, "Love especially from your little Noreen," with the word "your" underlined. Unable to trust his own eyes, his own wife, and the words of her spiteful and bitter sister, as hard as it was, he knew that the only person he could trust was his own daughter, Christine, who was only 12. When asked, Christine confirmed, "On at least 6 or 7 occasions, I have seen Bill and Gordon sleeping with my mother." And upon leaving the house to head to London, he said one of either two things.
"If anything happens, do what you can for the kids."
Or a phrase impossible to verify,
"I will do a rin, and I shall hang for it."
On Wednesday the 1st of August,
"I wandered about all day, trying to pluck up the courage.
Not to kill her, just to see her and talk to her, as he knew that the sight of her swollen belly would upset him." The next day, stealing his resolve with a few thick hits of rum, Civil headed to 12 Greenhill Road. Being a little inebriated, with a list of his wife's lovers in his hand, and May's words still ringing in his ears, he was in no state to be rational. Being drunk and tearful, Civil claimed,
"I lost my temper with the way she had let me down. We talked for a while, and then I asked her whatever made her do it. Only she didn't reply to the question."
Maybe she didn't want to, or maybe she didn't have an answer. But thrusting the list into her hand, she would defend, "I don't know who most of these people are." And although Civil wasn't a violent man, he hit her. Later that evening, Marge saw Kathleen in the shared kitchen. Her lip was cut and her mouth was bruised. She said her husband had hit her because she was carrying on with Yanks and Italians. In her room, he had spat,
"I could have forgiven you if it had been anyone else, but not our enemy."
And as several months of pent-up anger bubbled,
"How could you expect me to own a child that wasn't mine?"
he fumed. Ignoring the fact that Reggie wasn't his, and possibly the youngest too. And although she pleaded with him to stay, "I couldn't be introduced as the father of the child she was carrying, so I left." She shouted, "If you go now, you'll never see me again." But still I left. He needed to cool off. So that night, having bedded down in the Salvation Army hostel, being drained and exhausted, he slept. Early the next morning, he hand-delivered a letter through Kathleen's door. It read,
"Dear Kath,
Please be good enough to meet me half an hour from now, outside of the Odeon. Pat.
On the envelope, he had scrawled, "I love you." With Cyril's head downcast and sore, and Kathleen's mouth swollen and bruised, Cyril said, "When I saw her, I felt sorry because I knew that she was in trouble. I took her out for the day, and it brought back memories of when we used to go out together." They walked in the park. They went to the theatre, and they ate a meal in a cafe where they talked. He still loved her. But along with knowing the truth, he needed to see her remorse so he could forgive her. I asked her why she had gone as single, having used the alias of Miss Stanton rather than her married name of Mrs. Patmore. But she didn't reply. Asked what the Italian wanted to do, even though she said she hadn't seen him in a month. She would admit, "He waits for me every night. The arrangements were, I would have the child and his people would come over, take it and give me a lump sum, as if they were buying it."
From her bag, she took out a lot of Italian money and tore it up in front of me.
Whether she was committed to their future, their marriage or their children, he wasn't sure. Together they could make it work, and he knew that. But whether she could remain faithful, that he didn't know. After a pleasant walk in Paddington Green, Cyril walked her to the bus stop, saying, "Here, I'll wait with you till it comes." Thinking they had reached a resolution, she said, "You're coming home with me." Being a woman who believed she could get whatever she wanted from a man by using her body. Only with the bump between them, due within a week. Being a reminder of her infidelity, he turned her down.
I said, "No, that's impossible. How can you expect me to come back and sleep with you when you've been with another man?"
Like many servicemen, the one thing which had kept him alive was the thought of coming home and being with his beloved wife. "For years, I've waited for this moment to return. But I was robbed of everything." Their ruined relationship had a slim hope of survival. But it all rested on whether she loved him. On Saturday the 4th of August 1945, at 8:50 a.m, having slept fitfully, Private Cyril Patmore entered Greenhill Road in Harlesden. The street was silent, as the residents were roused by the chirp of a dawn chorus, the clatter of a milk cart, and Frederick Keeling, a driver for Taxilux, pulling up to await his passenger. Dressed in his battle dress, as expected of a soldier on leave, in his pockets, Cyril held the list, his wife's letters, and a 6-inch knife purchased as a souvenir at an Indian bazaar.
"I didn't know what to do," he would state, "but I wanted to see her. I loved her so much, and I had every intention of overlooking everything again."
Inside, Kathleen heard him knock at the front door. According to Marge, Kathleen said, "I expect that's my husband." And as she trembled, she said, "I'm finished. I don't know whether to open the door." She froze as his unmistakable shadow loomed over the frosted door pane just a few feet away. As she whispered, "I'll let him knock again. Perhaps he'll put the letter through the door and go away." Only he didn't. Informed of her immorality by her family, her sister, herself, and even her own children, for their sake, he wanted to give their marriage a chance. What he needed was the woman he had married and the mother of his children to show that she still loved him. But fed up with his questions and having rejected her, what he got was an uncouth and mouthy Kathleen who was unashamed of her actions. From the hallway, she led him into the empty kitchen at the rear of the ground floor. So with the lodgers in their rooms, no one would hear the foul words she would unleash in his reddening face. To the medical officer of Brixton Prison, Cyril confessed, "It was a casual and indifferent attitude." She said, "You've got a bag of nerves asking questions." I said, "Are you coming? Because I'm leaving." Thereby giving her an ultimatum that if they left, right now, there was still a possibility of saving what little of their relationship they had left. But with her shouting, "Do what the hell you like," Cyril would state, "I knew I was finished." Hearing a scream, and Kathleen shouting, "Marge, Marge," the tenants raced down to see Cyril. The knife in his hand, his sleeves bloodstained as he tottered out into the street. And knowing that his life was over, having uttered to Frank, "Get the police, I've just done my missus." Moments later, Cyril was arrested. At 9:05 a.m, Dr. Crowe, the police divisional surgeon, entered the ground floor kitchen to see the walls splashed with fresh warm blood, it dripping off the surfaces where the human ooze was yet to congeal. Lying face down on the tiled floor, wearing a print frock and blue ankled socks, Kathleen was pale and lifeless, as owing to her injuries, she was unconscious within a minute and dead within three. Bleeding profusely from a gaping wound to her throat, with no wounds to her hands nor any signs of a struggle, Cyril's blade had severed the small muscles of the neck, slicing open her right carotid artery and her right jugular vein, and draining her heart of blood. Kathleen was dead. But as Dr. Crowe rolled over her still warm corpse, seeing she was heavily pregnant and carrying inside of her a 10-pound and 4-ounce baby, which was barely a week from its birth, through her sopping wet and bloody dress, he saw its final kick, a starved of life. The baby died inside of her. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 28th of September 1945. The jury of 10 men and 2 women was said to be in tears as the testimony unfolded. Taking pity on Cyril, owing to the immoral ways of his wife, a verdict of manslaughter was returned, and he was sentenced to just 5 years in prison. With Mr. Justice Charles, incensed at the jury's decision, he stated,
"It would be the law of the jungle if a man, finding his wife, had been unfaithful once or even 20 times, was entitled to murder her and then say, 'But look at the provocation I've received.' But if manslaughter it be, I'm bound by the jury's verdict." Your counsellor said, "You were a sorely tried man. But if you had not been so sorely tried, I should have been bound to give you a very, very heavy sentence.
That sentence being death." As a key witness in the trial, May, who it was never proven was the anonymous writer of the letters penned by someone known only as Joe, openly spoke of her sister's wholesale immorality, which not only lessened her killer's sentence, but her spiteful words also condemned Kathleen to her death. Serving his time at Wormwood Scrubs, throughout his prison term, Cyril's concern was for the welfare of my children. And not trusting his wife's family, as far as we know, they were placed into care. Upon his release, Cyril Patmore went on to live a good life. He earned a living as a plumber. He remarried. He remained close to his children. And outliving his new spouse, he died in Southwark in 1999, never fully knowing the truth about the immoral Mrs. Patmore.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Oh, that's annoying. Oh, folks. Oh, there we go. Oh, halfway through that, my neighbour decided to put their engine on. So annoying. So effing annoying. I've dampened down the room as much as I can. But it's like, they were like, "Oh yeah, I need to watch something on telly. I'll just put my engine on really loud." It's a horrible hum. It's a really annoying hum in the background, which is probably going to permeate through everything and going to make this edit really fucking difficult. But that's the life of living on the waterway. You got to put up with this shit. Oh, there we go. Time for a cuppa, methinks. Cuppa o'clock. I'm going to have a... I think it's a peppermint today. So
There we go. Oh. Let's just... Right. Oh, that sound is echoing everywhere. I can't get rid of it. Annoying. I'm going to switch off my lights. My batteries charge up. There we go. Oh, what else is going on in the world apart from an annoying person next door? All she seems to do is watch telly all day. Just sits there watching telly all day, doesn't go anywhere, doesn't do anything, just watches telly all day. I mean, if she's a professional TV journalist, not that's really a job, is it? It's not really a job, is it? Kind of watching TV programmes and then giving your opinion on it. Not really a job. Not a proper job. Not really a journalist, is it? It's just, oh, I've watched something, I've made a decision about that. Critics, what's the point? So, what's going on? Apparently there's a blue moon tonight. So, we're going to keep an eye out for that tonight. Ooh, life doesn't get any more exciting than that. Weather-wise around here, it's all fine. I think because the whole of the world is burning at the moment. Therefore, because you have to have a balance in the world, if one side of the world is burning, the other half has to be wet, and in the middle it has to be ambient. So we've had a fine summer. I know they waffled on about June was the hottest on record, but that was June. July was kind of mid 20 degrees, August mid 20 degrees. About to tip into September, we're just on the cusp of September now. And it's probably going to do the same again. So, yeah, all very exciting. What else is going on? Off to see With and Lie again at the cinema very soon, but a screening with Bruce Robinson. So there we go, the writer and director of that. So that'll be good fun. Going to enjoy that. and I'm back in the archive soon. trying to gear myself up ready for December. I always like to do December in the archives. So I prepped to get all the episodes up and ready and out. So September, October, November, I'll be powering. I'll do my finish the rest of the research in a couple of weeks, and then I will power through the episodes because I'm in a good regime now. I can kind of get an episode done in 5 days. In the old days, it used to take 9 or 10 days. Now I can do it in about four or five. So that's good. So I'll get myself ahead of the game and get into the archives, and then I have my fun. I can spend all my time in the archives, going through all the murder files, having a look at all the fascinating stuff. It's really, really interesting. Just going through all the witness statements. Like, you know, sometimes with cases you see things written in newspapers, and it's only when you get the proper statements that you realise how selective it was, and the fact that the journalists haven't been given the statements. They were just sitting normally in court, and they're scribing it down, and it's kind of, you can see all the mistakes they've made, and you see what bits they've edited out, and it's only when you see the statements in full that you go, oh, this is more interesting than what we're being given. So that's why I really like that. Really exciting. So looking forward to some archive time, and having some time off over Christmas as well. That would be lovely. Shall I finish my kettle now? Yeah. Because otherwise I'm just going to... Let's see. Is it going to be hot or is it going to be cold? It's smoking. It's steaming a bit, so that'll do. It's a nice peppermint tea. Lovely, lovely. All good. We haven't had spider season yet. I was shocked by that. Normally, end of August, you have spider season and the little bastards are coming in. But I haven't had any spiders come in yet. Maybe it's too cold for them. We haven't had any good weather, so maybe that's it. Still no cake. Haven't had the cake in a long time. The last one I had was a one-off, which is the one to celebrate what I thought was the end of my bronchitis and ended up being the start of my ruptured eye. So I'm still struggling with that. I've partially sighted in my left, still. So all these episodes have been written and edited with one eye. You're welcome. So hopefully back in the hospital soon, and they can tell me what they can do about it. Hopefully they can do something about it. Lots of evil drugs in my eye. Lots of drugs where it says, don't get this in your central nervous system, because if you do, it's dangerous. And you think, oh, shit. But then suddenly you realise it's fine to put it in your eye, one of the most sensitive parts of your body, but not in the rest of your system. It's really baffling, but yeah. So we'll see how that goes. Right.
Don't forget, this is Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit, so don't complain if there's a mistake. Oh, you made a mistake. You said red. It's unedited. It's unedited. That's the point. So I'm going to do some quiz questions. Don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet, so some of these questions might not be in there. Don't get all stressy if some of the questions are... I only say this because sometimes people get in touch with me and they go, you missed out a question. It's like, so what? So what? Go and live your life. Have some fun. Get off the internet. Get off your phones. Stop staring at a phone. Stop obsessing about things that are unimportant. There's so much more important things in the world than whether someone sitting in their bedroom making a podcast for free for you for entertainment says red instead of blue. Who fucking cares? It baffles me. People on the internet just... I think the problem with the internet is it's given people a voice, and because a lot of people don't have a voice in real life or don't feel that they have a voice in real life, therefore they feel this is their moment. Oh, I've got to say something. I need to say something now. And it's like, no, you don't. What you need to do is go outside and talk to real people and have a life. Just do something. Read a book. Do something. But there's so many people who dedicate hours to every day being on their phone and their iPad or whatever. They're like, I need to comment on this. If you comment on more than two things a day on the internet, please go and get a life. There's so many people that I see out there who comment on everything. They have to give an opinion, and you just go, it's worthless. It's like I look at my Twitter account or whatever it's called today, and it says on there I've done over 10,000 tweets. And I never think to myself, oh, wow, this is amazing. I've done 10,000 tweets. I think to myself, wow, look at the amount of time I have pissed up the wall by writing shit for people who don't give a fuck. It's a massive waste of time. And if it were to all collapse tomorrow, you wouldn't have anything. Think about all that time that you could take, the time it's taken to think up and write 10,000 tweets. Could have... That's like five books. You could probably write five books in that time. You could probably have taken yourself out of a shit career that you hate and said to yourself, do you know what? I'm going to become a painter. I've always wanted to be a painter. And in the time it's taken you to write that, you could have become a painter. You could have done something with your life. But instead, people are obsessed with this idea of shit, of just commenting on shit. You don't need to comment on shit. You don't need to go on Facebook forums to comment on shit. It's like someone asks you what your favourite film is. Who fucking cares? Just do something with your life. It's just infuriating. But for some people, this is all they have. All they have is fucking internet. Jesus Christ. That's why I don't do a lot of social media. I post shit on there. If people say I enjoyed the episode, I always reply because it's politeness. I think leaving nice comments is nice. I always reply to nice comments. Horrible comments I normally delete. I always tell them to fuck off. I don't. I wish I'd love to, but I just delete them. But yeah, no. Leaving nice stuff is nice, but it's just people who feel they have to comment on everything. You just like, oh, just get off your phone for a second. Anyway, here's me saying get off your phone, and what I need you to do is to listen to my podcast, which kind of defeats the object. Oh, it's like talking about the environment and how we should all be saving the environment. But when you think about it, listening to podcasts, the amount of power it takes for you to download your podcast and times it by all the people who do, it's pretty crazy, really. It's like watching my mates always waffle on about the environment, but they love watching Netflix. And every time I have to point out to them that Netflix had to build their own power station in order to cope with all of the streaming that happens for you to download a program onto your own device. And think about all the power that has to be used on all these other platforms as well. The use of the internet. Like every time you do a Google search, the amount of servers it has to go through, who are all like based in Finland or Wisconsin or up to satellites and all that. You think about it. That is the equivalent of running a 60-watt bulb for 17 seconds. And that's just one Google search or any search, or even like on if you're on Telegram or WhatsApp and you feel you have to comment to a mate or you have to send them a stupid GIF or something like that, that's like 10 seconds of a 60 watt bulb, and we're all doing it constantly all day. So it's pretty bad, isn't it? We are a bad people. There you go. That was like 10 minutes of me just ranting about shit. If you like that, you might like Walk With Me. That's what I do. I walk, I talk about this episode, and then sometimes I end up in a rant because people piss me off. But there we go. Anyway, I've got my peppermint tea with me. That should calm me down. I doubt it, but it might. Right, let's do some quiz questions, then we'll dive into some extra stuff about the episode. Question number one. What was the company that Frank Keeling, the cab driver, worked for? Question number two. How far from Kathleen's house was the police station? These are all very difficult. Question number three. This is easy. What was the name of the inspector in charge of the investigation? Question number four. Which lorry driver was Kathleen supposedly having sex with in a field? Question number five, what pub was Kathleen and May said to be abusive in? Again, not a very good sentence structure there. Question number six, what was the name of the cottage where they slept with the Italian prisoners of war? Question number seven, in what village was the number 45 prisoner of war camp based? Question number eight, what train station did Civil arrive in from Burma? Question number nine, in what village did Uncle Horace live? What an idiot. I've written the answer there as Uncle Horace. I've just write it in there. And question number 10, what did Cyril allegedly say before leaving Uncle Horace's house to May? Right, let's see how my tea is. Oh, this is a very good peppermint tea. Oh, look at that. I'm all calm now. I have actually got a joss stick on. Doesn't seem to be doing any good. Right, let's dive into some extra stuff. My section in my article, because I have my Bible in front of me, and it's just a section called Shit Stirring in and the Name of Uncle Horace's Town. So, Tuesday the 31st of August, he went to Mr. and Mrs. Jenning, who is Uncle Horace and his wife, and May was there, and they were at Lower End Farm in name of village. So obviously when he got there, his kids were all there, and as mentioned, Christine was 12, Reggie 16, Noreen 4, Terry 6, and their youngest Kathleen. Also there was his sister-in-law, May. May's name, Mrs. May Canning, but this is what made it really confusing when I was trying to research this episode, because May Canning also goes by the name of Miss or Mrs. Seal. And therefore, we've also got Kathleen, who goes by, I can't remember what her name was, I think it was Miss Simpson or something like that. So obviously, when she was there, her sister... Not Horace did as well, but also her sister kind of told Cyril everything that she'd seen. But obviously she was selective with all the information that she got, because obviously she wasn't saying to him, well, I've been shagging Italians as well, and I've been having sex with the lorry drivers. Nope, not at all. So he said, from Mrs. Seal, which is May, I got a list of names. This was when I asked questions to find out who the father was. Miss Seal said the list was of the men my wife had been going with. This might have been done for spite, because my wife and sister fight like hell. He said, Mrs. Seal said, when you see your wife, ask her to pick out the one of that list. Which is... It's weird. I know she kind of... Her and her sister don't get on. But... Unless her sister was severely mentally unwell, surely she must have seen that the ramifications of her actions would have implications. Even if she doesn't love her sister, even if she doesn't love Cyril, she must have seen that the ramifications of that would have serious consequences on the children. And the children are oldest 16, youngest 3. And she's got her own children as well. What was going on in her effing head that she held on to a bitter spat from when she was a child, when they were growing up together, and even seeing that her sister was in a difficult situation, decided to make it even worse by being a massive bitch about it. And therefore, I would say, arguably, leading up to her sister's murder. I mean, what a fucker. What a nasty piece of shit. That's what made this a really interesting case for me, because it was kind of like, you know, we'd already covered cases before of people during wartime, and they're meeting up, and they're lonely, and they get into relationships. And, you know, we had the one with the Polish officer who became a bit of a stalker, and we had one of the kind of lady, her husband was away, her children were away, and she met a guy, and, you know, it ended badly as well. But this was one that I found interesting because of the sister, because of the way the family acted. And yes, Kathleen's behaviour is abhorrent, not just her behaviour, but also the way she's quite unashamed with it in front of people, and especially in front of her children. But it's her sister's behaviour that's even more baffling. I thought this was quite sad, that when he was there looking at his children, Cyril had already got kind of worries about which of his children weren't his. Obviously Reggie isn't his anyway, so he knows that, but they've allegedly got four children together. And it said, whilst there he looked at his own children, Kathleen age 6. He shook his head and said, I cannot make this out. Jenning, who is Horace, asked if the child was his, and he replied, I don't think so. I can't make it out. Why did she do this to me? I've played straight with her since I have been abroad. Maisie Steele, 27, who's the niece of Kathleen, so that's one of May's daughters, stated Cyril looked at his daughter and said, they're just like the bastard, in reference to Mr. Tobin, so that's Frank Tobin. He then wiped his brow. I've written brown there for some reason. He wiped his brow. That would be a very different story. He wiped his brow on the back of his hand and said, Jesus Christ. And obviously, as mentioned in the episode, he'd already seen a letter written by Kathleen to Frank Tobin last Christmas. And on these were the words, love, especially from your, in capital letters, little Noreen. And she'd underlined your multiple times. I mean, that's not exactly being discreet about it, really. So we don't really know where he saw it, but he definitely did. And so that's pretty sad. Also sitting down with his 12-and-a-half-year-old daughter, Christine. So Christine was the, except Reggie, she was the oldest of their biological children. He took her out to the day, gave her a nice meal. I think they went out for a meal or something in Oxford, and it was there he was like, I need to ask you some questions, tell me what you did see. And she was like, what's she going to do? She's 12 and a half years old, and she's torn between her mother and her father. Her mother, who's not exactly being motherly, and her father, who hasn't been around a lot in her early years because of the war. So she's torn in a difficult situation, and God knows what that did for her for the rest of her life, knowing that the words that she said may have contributed to her mother's death, given the fact that her father killed her mother. So that would have made for a horrible situation. Didn't put this in the episode. Thursday the 2nd of August at 10:30 a.m. Cyril went to see Frank Tobin. It's fascinating, given the fact that he suspects Frank Tobin of being the father of his youngest, and yet he still regards him as a friend. Frank would send him letters overseas to reassure him that everything was fine. And he's even one of the people who Cyril goes to see before the murder. And Frank said he was crying. He said, I've seen the children. They're in rags. They're hungry. It's broke my heart. After all I've done in this war and the time I've been in the jungle, just thinking of my wife and children. From inquiries I've made from my own relatives, I found out she carried on with nearly every man in the village, even the wops. That's slang for Italians. Tobin advised me to forget his wife and get the children settled. Cyril agreed, but said... no, that's fine. It does make you wonder whether Frank wanted to be dating Kathleen, and therefore that's why he advised him to forget his wife and get his children settled. Obviously, from the earlier episode, you'll remember that she said that she was walking home on a celebration of his birthday and their wedding anniversary. So that was back in November. She got drunk. She was walking home. It was roughly 4 miles. And that she had been, inverted commas, seduced. He asked who the father was, and she said it was Antonio Frunzo. Sometimes his name is listed as Soldata Frunzo Antonio. But that's because it's flipped around the wrong way, because it's a military, it is military reference they're getting it from. When he was in Brixton Prison, the medical officer, he said to the medical officer, it was his wife's casual and indifferent attitude when they met, which was the kind of the catalyst for murder. He also said he had no intention of killing his wife. He only intended to mar her, which begs the question of why he had the knife with him. Was it, was given the fact that most people in their battle dress would have had a utility belt as well, which has all the things that you'd put in there as well, and he'd have his kit bag with him. So likelihood is he may have just had his knife with him, as something he would naturally carry around anyway, but he may have intentionally brought it with him, just as he intentionally brought the letters he'd received from her with him. Let's see, let's scroll down a little bit more. As mentioned, they the day before, they had a relatively nice day. They went to see the theatre. They went out and had a meal. She'd pawned off some of his clothes, and that's what he meant by personal belongings. It was, he wanted the pawn tickets back. So we don't really know what she had pawned of his, but it was definitely clothes. I won't go through his whole witness statement. Day of the murder. So, Marge was talking to Kathleen at the door around 8:40 a.m. It was actually probably about 8:50 a.m. She said there was a knock at the door. Kathleen said, "I expect that's my husband." She trembled and said, "I'm finished. I don't know whether to open the door. I'll let him knock again. Perhaps he'll put a letter through the door." But there was a knock, and she decided to let him in. Now, Cyril would say, "I saw her, and I asked her to come upstairs into the room and to talk," because he wanted to talk to her privately. She stood there, cool and defiant, and said, "Wait a minute and see my friends." I think that means the lodgers. He said, "I don't want to see anyone." She said, "Since you've been back, you've got a bag of nerves asking questions." I said, "Are you coming because I'm leaving?" And she said, "You know everything. I've told you everything. Do what the hell you like." And he said, I knew then that I was finished. That's all. I only meant to scar her so that nobody else could have her but me. She struggled and I stabbed her in the wrong place. So we don't know whether that's real. Ernest Thwaites, who was one of the lodgers, I think he was the landlord, said he heard Kathleen screaming. He said, "I heard a terrible scream. I got a hiccup, sorry. She shouted, 'Marge, Marge,'" which was her new best friend who lived there. Thwaites came downstairs and saw her lying on the floor, covered in blood and groaning. He spoke to her but got no reply. Don't forget she's going into unconsciousness at that point, because blood is draining out of her body. He then went into the street and asked the driver to fetch for the police. Marge, after the scream, raced downstairs, and she reached the first step of the passage leading to the kitchen. Patmore, which is Cyril, came through the kitchen door. He had a knife in his right hand. His trousers were bloodstained, and as he tottered by, he was mumbling something unheard. She looked into the kitchen, and Kathleen was sat on a chair by the fireplace, bent forward with her back to the door. Marge then called her husband and Mr. Thwaite, and then remained in her room. So Kathleen was on the chair. When the police finally turned up, the chair was overturned, but that's because she'd sat on it, and then she passed out. There were two other lodgers in the house, but they don't really recall anything because they were further up the house. The discovery. So Detective Sergeant Gibbs was actually the first on scene, directed by an occupant to the ground floor flat at the rear. He said her position, she was face down, lifeless, on her stomach, head inclined to the right. In falling, she had overturned a kitchen chair. She was bleeding profusely and appeared to be lifeless. He sent for an ambulance. The doctor arrived, Dr. Crow. She was declared dead at 9:05 a.m. So about 10 minutes later. He said it was very recent. The woman was lying on her back close to the fireplace. There was a gaping wound of her throat, 1.5 inches long, running from the midline of the neck towards the right-hand side. The incision penetrated deeply. There was also an incised wound, 1.5 long, on the left-hand side of the forehead above the eyebrow. We don't know whether he hit her or whether she hit the floor. But obviously, as mentioned in the episode, it was Dr. Crowe who he saw that she was dead. She was very, very, very pale. There was no movement. By that point, there was no blood in her heart. That had been entirely drained out. And the floor and the walls were absolutely covered in blood. And that's when he turned over her body and saw what he said was the final kick. The final movement of the child, he said. Cyril was arrested, taken to X Division, which is Harlesden area, informed of the murder. As mentioned, Cyril kind of said, "I've done my wife in." He gave the address, 12 Greenhill Road. "I have come from India," he said. "I did it with this," and he produced a closed pocket knife from his right trouser pocket. Boat going past. Music on. Not looking where they're going, on their phones, not a care in the world, utter arseholes. Police inspector said that he would be arrested. He was cautioned. Patmore said to think it was an Italian she was going with. So that's the interesting thing throughout this episode, is that even though I think it's more likely that one of the lorry drivers from the first place she was staying was more than likely to be the father of the child, because we're at war and because the Italians are the enemy at that point, all the blame is being put on the Italians. But it's unlikely that it was them. Of course, given the fact that the baby's gone, the baby's dead, we can't do a DNA test on it, no one will now know whose baby it was, really. She was roughly, they determined her as a roughly 40 weeks pregnant, so she was full term. Baby was 10 pounds and 4.5 ounces. She had no protective marks on the hands or arms. As mentioned, she was unconscious within a minute and dead within three. Cause of death, hemorrhage by stab wound. He was formally charged. He admitted that he'd done it. Where was that? On his possessions, 2 books of clothing rations in her name. He also had her handbag. But also in her handbag was his army pay book, and his allowance was £4.05 a week. I was going to use that in the episode, but I decided not to. Before his trial, he was held at Brixton Prison. His committal was at Willesden Magistrates Court on the 5th of August at 10 a.m, and he was charged that on the 4th of August he did willfully murder Kathleen Parsons, and he was placed on remand. Pretty much, I think, everything that we needed to be put into the episode about the trial itself. I think that is it. Oh, no. So with Mr. Justice Charles, he was the one who said, "We've kind of got a weird situation here that you've taken sympathy for this man who's found his wife cheating and has come back, and he's murdered her, and you've kind of accepted his provocation as reasons to lower it from a murder charge to a manslaughter charge, owing to the fact of her, what they would say, wholesale immorality." But he did say this was the second case in that month tried at the Old Bailey where a returning officer had found out that his wife had become pregnant by another man. He had killed her, but had been found guilty of manslaughter by provocation. So I think that's it. We've kind of done everything that was in that. As mentioned, he remarried when he was 51. His profession was engineer and plumber's mate. He was a widower at the time of his death. He died in Wandsworth over on Cavendish Road, and he died of pneumonia and COPD. He passed away February 1999 in Southwark. So I think that's everything I can tell you on that. Hope you enjoyed that episode, if indeed you can enjoy an episode, because they're all grim, aren't they? So let's do some quiz questions, and then I'll crack on with the editing. Oh, ooh, Question number one. What company did Frank Keeling, the cab driver, work for? It was called Taxilux. I know full well that when I stop recording, Lady Next Door is going to switch off her engine. Question number two. How far from Kathleen's house was the police station? It was half a mile. Question number three. What was the name of the inspector in charge of the investigation? Come on, you should have got this one. It was Inspector Coote. Question number four. Which lorry driver was Kathleen supposedly having sex with in a field? It was Gordon. Question number five, what pub were Kathleen and May said to be abusive in? It was the Seacourt Bridge Hotel in Botley, which is still there today. Question number six, what was the name of the cottage where they slept with the Italian prisoners of war? It was the Nunnery, that's still there today. Question number seven, in what village was the number 45 prisoner of war camp based? That was North Hinksey. She's lowered her engine noise now. That's really... She's switched off her effing engine. Oh, that is so annoying. That is so annoying. I might have a listen to it and redo it. Question number eight. What train station did Cyril arrive at from Burma? It was St. Pancras. In what village did Uncle Horace live? It was Thrupp. And question number 10, I think I got the numbers out of order, that's fine. What did Cyril allegedly say before leaving Uncle Horace's house to May? Apparently, she said he said, I will do her in and I shall hang for it. So there we go, folks. There we go. I think I'm going to try and re-record some of this now that fuckface has switched off a bloody engine. So that's me done, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. I've got another hour's worth of work to do after this. Oh, bloody hell. Anyway, thank you for supporting the show. Stay safe and be good. I'm going to put your little hat on so I can get back to recording. And I'm going to put the little pop screen back in so I can do that. I can't remember when her effing engine went on. So I'll just have to wing it. I just wing it. There we go. Anyway, have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye. Oh, that's not law. Let's do it from here. Okay. Oh.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.